Welcome back to ABCs in Dermatology from HCP Live. We are here on the ground in Denver, Colorado at the American Academy of Dermatology 2026. I'm Chris Bunick, and I am here with my co-host, Dr. Lindsay Ackerman. Lindsay, we are here.
We are here. We've made it. Oh my goodness, what a meeting. Again, late breakers, always something that I think we both find very interesting. And this year, I would argue maybe even practice changing. So quite a lot of interesting data. I'm excited today to talk to you about three key trials that were presented at the late breakers today.
I think this year in particular is just a lot of really, really good data. But like as you said, we only have time to talk about a few on this particular episode.
So I'm going to ask actually one of them that caught my eye specifically was the Lilly-sponsored trial looking at a combination of both tirzepatide and ixekizumab. We know those as Zepbound and Taltz for the treatment of our patients with psoriasis, moderate to severe disease, who are obese or overweight with a comorbid risk factor, hypertension, diabetes, et cetera. What did you take home as the big take home of that particular comparator trial?
Well, we know that there's a big interrelationship between the cardiometabolic dysfunction and psoriasis. We've talked about it for years, and this is the first study to really hone in on this new class of molecules in the incretin family, the GLP-1 agonist, and how they can work together with our existing psoriasis drugs to make an impact for psoriasis patients. So I was really fascinated to understand what these results showed for plaque psoriasis. And the primary endpoint that they were looking at in this particular trial was looking at PASI 100 response plus 10% or more body weight loss or reduction at week 36.
And it was head-to-head with ixekizumab plus tirzepatide versus ixekizumab alone. Primary endpoint was assessed at week 36. And I think that was in, you know, we're not used to week 36 endpoints in psoriasis, but because that 10% body weight loss was one of the combined outcome measures of the primary endpoint, PASI 100 plus a 10% body weight loss.
Right. And the average BMI in this particular population was around 39.
Yeah. Which, when you look at most of our pivotal trials for psoriasis drugs, the BMI is high, but not 39. I mean, the BMI is, you know, arguably, I would say, about 10 points less on the BMI scale for most of our pivotal trials. So large, large persons with, you know, arguably more surface area and more circulating volume.
All right. When you say surface area, the BSA involved in this particular cohort of patients was around 25% on average.
Yeah. And something that I will say, right or wrong, I was actually thinking to myself, when you look at a BMI average of 39 and you think that 25% BSA is involved, the total volume of actual plaque psoriasis is really high. I mean, think about the volume on a human that's, you know, a BMI of 19 versus a BMI of 39. The actual overall plaque volume of psoriasis is higher too.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And in this particular cohort, beyond all of the BMI and the body surface area, about 97% of these patients had some form of a special site involvement, such as the scalp or the genitals, et cetera. So Lindsay, what is the primary endpoint outcome? Again, the primary endpoint was PASI 100 plus a 10% weight loss at week 16. How many met it on tirzepatide plus ixekizumab versus ixekizumab alone?
Yeah, 27% of this, arguably, again, morbidly obese population or obese population with a risk factor, cardiometabolic risk factor, met the primary endpoint of both a PASI 100 and at least a 10% body weight loss versus 6% in the ixekizumab population alone. And again, that was a week 36 endpoint, but that's a 21-point delta, 27% versus 6%. That to me was measurable. But I would argue even maybe potentially more scientifically meaningful to me would be the secondary endpoint of PASI 100. Tell me about what you saw. That's PASI 100 alone, independent of weight loss. As we know, those that were on tirzepatide were much more likely to cross the line for the primary endpoint.
Right, and that's absolutely right. If you just look at weight loss in general, those that were on tirzepatide clearly had significantly greater weight loss. But if you take the actual weight loss measure out and you look at just PASI 100 response at week 36, what you see is about a 12% delta. About 40% of patients hit PASI 100 at week 36 compared to about 29 that were on ixekizumab alone. So the combination did do better in hitting PASI 100. If you look at the relative increase, that's a 40% relative increase in hitting PASI 100. This is massively increasing the quality of life and really the standard of care of treating psoriasis patients.
I think it forces us to have the conversation with ourselves about what are we going to do in this next iteration of practice where GLPs are becoming more and more frequent and frankly in use by many of our patients, but frankly more and more determinatively helpful for many of our patients with chronic inflammatory disease. I'm almost looking at it the way I sort of perceived what was my responsibility 5 years ago when JAKs were coming to market for treatment of dermatologic chronic inflammatory diseases. This might be the next iteration of that. It's almost as though, you know, at this point, I feel like if you haven't embraced the use of JAKs for many different inflammatory diseases, you're sort of like, you're not practicing medicine in the 21st century. I feel that way about potential, you know, these GLPs or the incretins and the analogs that are coming to market. We have to start understanding them better. We're going to have to understand how to prescribe them, when they're useful for our patients, when maybe they're not the right patients.
I sort of view it, Lindsay, as this. We have thought of ourselves in dermatology as cutaneous physicians, but the reality, this data fits with what we've been learning about a number of impacts of the systemic inflammation on AD, other psoriasis, of course, alopecia, but we are cutaneous cardiometabolic physicians now.
And immunologic physicians.
And immunologic physicians.
I agree with
you. And I think that that's what this data says.
Yeah.
In terms of safety, the adverse events that were seen in this population were really mild to moderate with known profiles of each of these agents, the tirzepatide and the ixekizumab.
Which again, I want to emphasize because we're talking about an arguably high-risk population. I mean, these patients have higher risk status for serious infections, higher risk status for MACE events, higher risk status for even cutaneous infections like intertrigo. And here we're not really seeing any signals, which is great.
Just a little bit of nausea, diarrhea, constipation, injection site reaction, vomiting, dizziness. Those are the main ones that were seen in about 5% or more rate.
Comparable with what we would understand given tirzepatide and ixekizumab's risk profiles.
So the data that we just talked about is the Together PSO phase 3B trial. But I do want to point out there was a Together PSA trial where the primary endpoint was ACR 50 and 10% weight loss. So this was asking a different question, looking at joints, not PASI 100 response. And what was really interesting in this data is that it was very positive, just like the skin data that we talked about, and that the joint improvement was happening as early as 4 weeks before significant weight loss was happening. And when you looked at the primary endpoint, when you have the combo of the tirzepatide and ixekizumab, you had roughly 32% of patients hitting this ACR 50 plus 10% weight loss at week 36 compared to just 0.8%.
Yeah, no, no doubt. Again, I think this emphasizes how we have to conceptualize the idea of treating a person and not just a disease state. That indeed, when we are looking at the human before us, we must understand more robustly the pathogenesis of inflammation and include obesity as a part of that. And I also think taking it one step further, it allows us in some ways to sort of destigmatize this disease of obesity for our patients that otherwise, you know, it's frankly a hard conversation to have many times with patients, you know, to encourage them to lose weight and to exercise and to eat right and all those things. Because the last thing you want to do is have them embrace some sort of sentiment of blame. That's not the idea. But if we have actually something we can do to help them facilitate their wellness overall as it pertains to obesity and moreover, achieve higher yield outcomes for their chronic inflammatory diseases within dermatology, it's a win-win.
So you mentioned about the systemic inflammation and in the Together PSA trial, they actually did look at high sensitivity CRP.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was a fourfold decrease of high sensitivity CRP with the combination therapy compared to ixekizumab alone, showing that there are systemic inflammatory benefits happening when you combine these types of modalities. And I think that when we look forward to treating all types of inflammatory skin diseases, we are going to probably see more and more attention paid to looking at the systemic the biomarkers of systemic inflammation. High sensitivity CRP is one of them.
Yeah.
There are many others that we need to follow. But I think that was a really interesting point that stood out to me. And together, pun intended, PSO and PSA, these are really transformative trials in terms of how we think about looking at the entire patient.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I actually can't wait to see beyond just the disease and disorder of psoriasis and the psoriatic diathesis, what other disease mitigations we're going to be able to achieve with these agents.
One last point I wanted to make is we don't really think about the adipocytes and their role in driving psoriatic disease. And I do know that there's some emerging literature that shows that there actually is a role for the adipocytes or fat cells in driving the skin plaques. And I think that these trials inspire me to go back and look at that literature that's emerging and try to better understand the role of the adipocytes in driving psoriatic and psoriatic arthritis pathogenesis.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, Chris. It's an interesting phenomenon that we've observed for many, many years that those that have more visceral obesity, central obesity, carry higher risks of heart disease, carry higher risks of having psoriasis. And then when you actually distill down what those adipocytes are doing biologically, it's remarkable. They are emitting a myriad of cytokines that are actually culprit in driving so many of the diseases we see every day. So I'm very excited about what we're learning in this category together, PSO, PSA. Thanks for chatting with me about it. Can we move on to the next one too?
Let's do it. Let's together move on to atopic dermatitis.
That sounds great.
So in the atopic dermatitis space, we also had a really interesting late breaker looking at an extended half-life drug known as zumilokibart. Lindsay, what can you tell us about how zumilokibart works?
Yeah, this is actually an exciting molecule coming to us from a new company in dermatology, Apogee Therapeutics. This molecule is an IL-13 monoclonal antibody. It is very similar mechanistically to how we think about tralokinumab or lebrikizumab. The epitope target is much more similar, Chris, to lebrikizumab than it is tralokinumab. But nonetheless, it's focusing on a monoclonal antibody to IL-13 in the treatment of moderate to severe atopic dermatitis.
Absolutely. And this targeting is very important. And it distinguishes zumilokibart from other IL-13s in development. But what really also distinguishes it is this extended half-life YTE technology.
Exactly. So the presumption is that with an extended half-life of an IL-13 monoclonal antibody, potentially with tight binding affinity and a slow disassociation constant, perhaps we could extend the dose interval for patients with moderate to severe disease. And actually, that's exactly what Apogee presented at this late breaker. It was the maintenance of response in patients who had been induced. Their induction regimen was a week 0, week 2, week 4, and then week 12 induction dosing, followed by either a Q12 or Q24 week dose administration over the balance of time until week 52 was achieved. That was reached. So until the balance of time until week 52 was reached. The primary endpoint was EASI-75 and IGA-0/1 at week 16. And what did you find interesting about the data, both at week 16 and then that maintenance late breaker data from week 16 to week 52?
Right. So what we know from this phase 2A study is that in the first part, the first 16 weeks, what we generally saw from the patients was about 75% of them hit EASI-75 at week 16. And what this particular 52-week late breaker data showed was the maintenance of that EASI-75 response between week 16 and week 52.
And I want to just mention, even that week 16 primary efficacy endpoint would be novel therapeutic infrequency, if you will, a week 0, a week 2, a week 4, and a week 12. So patients have effectively had 4 doses by the time they reached that week 16 primary endpoint.
Right. And the doses, the first 2 doses at week 0 and 2 were actually 720 milligrams. Yeah. And then the next ones at 4 and 12 weeks were 360 milligrams. So this is a slightly different dosing regimen as well, where we have higher doses trying to get that high early response. Mm-hmm. And that does play into this high EASI-75 response at week 16. And then when you look out to week 52, what we see is that approximately 75% of patients maintain that EASI-75 with Q3 month dosing. So let's think about in AD, Q3 month dosing.
Well, go even further. They have a Q20.
What? Even further? Is that possible?
Yeah. Q24 week dosing was assessed in this late breaking data. And phenomenal. Thinking about 85% of our patients, the overwhelming majority, maintaining an EASI-75 and dosing every 24 weeks. Now, I want to call out, this is a small phase 2A, as you mentioned. It's a smaller study. I want to say that I think at week 52, we were assessing 50 total patients, but still remarkable to think that we can maybe get away with a Q12 or Q24 week dose schedule with IL-13 inhibition.
We are bringing, when you start thinking Q3 month, Q6 month dosing intervals to maintain a response, that is truly game-changing, revolutionary in atopic dermatitis. But we just talked about EASI-75. I want to put this into context, IGA 0 or 1, because IGA 0 or 1 would represent an optimal treatment target in the current treat-to-target framework.
Absolutely.
In terms of skin clearance. And the reality is the numbers were about the same. About 86% maintained IGA 0 or 1 with Q3 month dosing and 78% with Q12 week dosing. So we're falling somewhere in that 75 to 85% maintenance.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And just for our audience to remember that an IGA 0 or 1 is clear. That means visually inspecting 100% of the body, not one iota of any of the morphologies that we would associate with atopic dermatitis. And that's, you know, erythema, papulation, lichenification, or excoriation. But an IGA 1, which is nearly clear, means that patients almost have quite literally no detectable disease. And as an investigator in these trials, and I know you do them as well, I mean, for the erythema scale, you have to squint to see erythema to give a patient a morphology of 1. So that's the degree of clearance we're talking about with IGA 0/1.
And what was also seen in that data, and what was also seen in the Zumilokibart data in this phase 2A trial, was that there was the early response and the response continued to grow beyond week 16. So this is a drug that continues to get better over time, according to this trial data.
I think it actually begs the question of what we consider disease control, disease modification, disease remission, and then disease cure. You know, these definitions that we're actually getting to engage with because our treatment outcomes are so deep. So when we take a patient who's actually done quite well and at week 16 has had an IGA 0/1 or an EASI-75 and then continues to get better with less frequent dosing, we're going to have to start categorizing what that means. Is that disease control, or now is it disease modification, or ultimately remission and cure? Just interesting conceptual questions, I think, for us to contemplate moving into the future. But very excited about Zumilokibart.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. I think this has the chance to really change how patients are compliant with their therapy, but also the quality of life in terms of dosing frequency and actually elevating the standard of care in the biologic space. And when I say that, what I mean is that when we look at network meta-analyses and we look at kind of that EASI-90 response, the biologics at the current biologics, you're hitting around 30 to 32% response at week 16 in that network meta-analysis. And if you use as observed data, not NRI, but as observed data, looking at EASI-90, the week 16 response for Zumilokibart is somewhere in that 30 to 40% ballpark. And I think because of that, there is a lot of optimism, and we're going to have to see what plays out in the phase 3.
Yeah. No, again, very, very excited. I think we need larger trials, of course. They're planning a phase 3 and hoping to have, you know, much larger number. I think they're aiming for about 350 patients, which will be great.
So, Lindsay, what can you tell us about the side effect profile of Zumilokibart?
Yeah. So, actually, what we saw was what we would expect with the interleukin-13 inhibition mechanism. Conjunctivitis comes up. I think it was about 20% in this particular trial, which is within the same realm of what we see with other IL-13 antibodies, IL-4-13 antibodies. You know, small n's, Chris, it's hard to know. I mean, is this slightly higher than the others? But the n is quite small. So effectively, I think that it's just going to have to play out in phase 3.
Excellent. Well, there you have it. Zumilokibart in atopic dermatitis. The
late breaker
at AAD 2026. Really showing some transformative potential for our AD patients.
Yes. So now we're going to hit number 3 from the late breakers at AAD Denver 2026. Takeda, another new company in dermatology, but not a new company in medicine. In fact, what I think is fairly impressive is they have a 245-year history in the pharmaceutical industry. They're presenting today at the late breaking session a zasocitinib new molecule that's a modified TYK2. We might say next generation next-generation TYK2 inhibitor for the treatment of moderate to severe plaque psoriasis in our adult population. What did you take home from this late breaker, Chris?
Well, this late breaker was emphasizing the phase 3 data of zasocitinib. And as you said, this is actually an AI-guided next-generation TYK2 inhibitor. And this is our first look at phase 3 data from a next-gen TYK2 inhibitor. And what we observed were more than half of the patients at week 16 hit PASI 90. Think about that. Half of your patients could have PASI 90 in just 16 weeks. And there were 44 ranked secondary endpoints, and zasocitinib hit all 44, including head-to-head with apremilast.
Yeah. Which I just want to say, calling out this phase 3 study, these were large studies. There were two phase 3 global multicenter studies here presented. One had an N of 693 patients enrolled, and the other had over 1,100 patients enrolled. We're talking about a once-daily oral molecule with about a million-fold specificity for TYK2 over the other JAK proteins, JAK1, JAK2, JAK3. So you said novel AI-guided. I mean, I liken this to almost like, TYK2 inhibition, and perhaps if we were maybe suboptimally pleased with our deucravacitinib arm, if we had historically been potentially suboptimally pleased with what deucravacitinib could offer our patients, this is not another reinvented deucravacitinib molecule. This is a molecule that's like taking Subaru to Ferrari, right?
You know, Lindsay, I think you hit the nail on the head, and that is probably one of the most important things for our listeners to take away. This next generation TYK2 inhibitor, it is not deucravacitinib. It is way, way more than that. And I don't know about Subaru, but when I was first learning to drive, I had a Jeep Grand Cherokee. So this is like going This is like going from a Jeep Grand Cherokee to a Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
And how do we know that? Well, we know that because the co-primary endpoints in this particular phase 3 trial, the Latitude PSO trial, was PGA 0/1 and PASI 75 versus placebo at week 16. And both of these co-primary endpoints were met, and the PASI 75 signal was seen as early as week 4.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, all 44 ranked secondary endpoints were met, which included PASI 75, but PASI 90, PASI 100, and SPGA 0 versus both placebo and apremilast. And, you know, apremilast has been around a very long time. So many of us are very familiar with apremilast, and we recognize that apremilast has its limitations, both in efficacy and potential deepening of response over time being a little more limited, and also the side effect profile. I mean, it is true that apremilast sometimes confounds its own success by patients being unable to maintain their dosing because of intolerance. And frankly, when we think about a pill that can be offered once daily at week 16 and yield a PASI 100, completely clear skin in about 30% of our patients as early as 16 weeks, I think that's kind of game-changing in the oral market, potentially.
I think so. If I were advising or counseling a patient, I would say you have a 1 in 3 chance of hitting PASI 100 in just 16 weeks. I think that's a very simple message that patients can get. And truly, this is also a once daily pill is transformative in the oral psoriasis market. And beyond that, it was very safe and well tolerated. The most common adverse events were the things you commonly see: upper respiratory tract infection, nasopharyngitis. There were no new safety signals. There was some acne, as we've seen in some of the JAK inhibitor related, JAK family inhibitors.
And low level acne, I mean, similar to what we would expect with other TYK2 inhibitors.
Yeah, we could spend a whole podcast talking about, is it really acne? Is it some type of special folliculitis? And the underlying mechanisms are still poorly understood. But the reality is, this was a very safe medicine, very effective medicine. And one of the cool things about the pathophysiology behind it is that because of that, as you were talking about, that 1 million-fold selectivity for TYK2 over the other JAKs, it maintains its efficacy. When you look at the pharmacokinetics, it maintains that efficacy over time, and that translates into really inhibiting the IL-23 pathway over 24 hours.
Yeah.
And that is another point, Lindsay, is I want our colleague dermatologists to understand, when you hear TYK2 inhibitor, it is also an IL-23 inhibitor. It's the same family, but instead of hitting the IL-23 cytokine or the IL-23 receptor, we're actually inside the cell,
diminishing the production of IL-23.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. No, and I'm excited as well just to know that, again, Takeda, a new company to us, but a very, very, very robust history in medicine of 245 years. They're an enormous pharmaceutical company across other medical subspecialties, GI, rheumatology, other, you know, specialties that overlap in what I would consider the psoriatic diathesis of inflammation. And in their head-to-head pipeline, they actually have studies underway looking, again, versus deucravacitinib at PSA, but also looking at some phase two studies coming up in Crohn's, UC, vitiligo, HS. So I think a lot to come from Takeda and this particular molecule. I'm pretty excited about zasocitinib.
One of the things that's really important to understand about TYK2, and I think it puts these results into the context and why this is so important for the health of our patients, there is a natural variant that humans carry that inactivates TYK2. There are humans walking around on this earth with about 80 to 90% inactive TYK2 or less active TYK2 because of a natural mutation in the kinase domain.
And they don't get psoriasis.
They have much less risk of psoriasis. They also have less risk of other autoinflammatory diseases.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is what is important. We know scientifically and medically that this is a really good target because it is naturally occurring in humans and confers an autoimmune risk benefit. And I think that's where I'm really looking forward to seeing some of the nitty-gritty analyses of zasocitinib beyond the phase three, you know, primary and ranked secondary endpoints. Mm-hmm. I want to know, how is it affecting the overall immunology of our patients? How is it affecting, as we talked earlier in the earlier segment, how is it affecting that cardiometabolic risk and function of our patients?
Yeah. Let alone, just like you say, its impact potentially on other chronic inflammatory diseases, autoimmune diseases, vitiligo, HS, et cetera. A lot to come, I think, for Takeda in our future with zasocitinib and potentially other molecules. But exciting, Chris. Thanks so much for reviewing all three of these late breakers with me. I know we're going to have to depart, but before we go, can you tell me just anything else you took home from the meeting that you think would be noteworthy for our guests?
You know, I think there were so many exciting new releases, whether they're late breaker or regular. You know, just a couple one-liners that I'll talk about that's going to be really important discussions for us to have on this podcast going forward and in the community of dermatology. And first, we're going to have to talk more about amlitelimab and the OX40 ligand pathway. HS, a lot of revolution in HS. We have sonelokimab, which is the nanobody from MoonLake. We have povorcitinib, which is a JAK1 selective inhibitor with high tissue penetration from Incyte. We also have upadacitinib.
Yeah, and lutikizumab also, both being brought to us by AbbVie.
So HS pipeline is really exploding. Beyond HS, hair loss.
Oh, yeah.
Pattern
extended
hair
release, yeah. Extended release minoxidil was hot this meeting.
Yeah, and I think that I'd love to talk more about this in the future, but our listeners, as a teaser, did you know minoxidil needs to be activated? Minoxidil by itself doesn't work. If it's not sulfated, it has to be sulfated to work.
And that's why actually topical minoxidil doesn't seem to work as well. We have far fewer of that enzyme, the sulfate required enzyme, in our scalp, in our skin, than we do in our GI tract. If it passes through first pass metabolism, we actually bioactivate kinetically the minoxidil molecule.
I was also excited, Lindsay, by seeing reflumilast in 3-month to 24-month pediatric patients with AD. That was exciting, with itch relief as early as 10 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of things actually now penetrating the pediatric market, which is so great to see. I mean, an overlooked population for so long, whether it's nemolizumab and you're talking about atopic dermatitis, whether you're talking about upadacitinib and vitiligo, a lot of new interventions for our pediatric patients that are suffering.
We could go on and on. Upadacitinib and alopecia areata as well as looming.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the other things we did just talk about, you know, next generation TYK2 inhibitors. We also had a late breaker for invudocitinib, which is a twice daily next generation TYK2 inhibitor. And we haven't even touched on it. We have icotrokinra, a IL-23 receptor peptide. IL-23 receptor inhibitor is a cyclic peptide that targets the IL-23 receptor. beyond that, this has been a truly revolutionary AAD in Denver.
It really has been. And, you know, the ICO, you know, obviously the approval came just before AAD. Incredible technology that is really, I think, filling a lane in the oral therapeutic market that we need to hit a little better than we have thus far.
And Lindsay, I just remembered, we cannot forget about our rare diseases.
Oh, yeah.
Dermatomyositis.
Absolutely.
Big news. What was the big news?
Repetitive. Yeah. Yes. We're going to finally have a drug for dermatomyositis. Are you kidding me? We're anchoring now more into, you know, chronic connective tissue diseases, lupus. We're going to have new studies for lupus that Biogen's looking at. We've reinvented companies within dermatology, new companies within dermatology, a lot of new molecules. Gosh, 2026 was just...
2026 is just getting started.
Exactly. It was a great meeting.
I really am excited. For those that don't know, the phase 3 data for brepocitinib in dermatomyositis, it was actually published in New England Journal of Medicine here during the course of the AAD. If you haven't seen it, please go read it. Shout out to all the rare diseases in dermatology, but also to all patients with dermatologic disease, because we are innovating and we are coming to help you.
And we thank you for helping us in our clinical trials. Thank you also to our audience for listening today. This has been HCP Live, ABCs in Dermatology with Dr. Chris Bunick and myself, Dr. Lindsay Ackerman. Thanks so much.